Chapter 4. Before we investigated the abandoned space station for real, we practiced maneuvers in vacuum and zero gravity. I ordered the ship to halt in interstellar space, and Desai flew the flower a short distance away to act as a target. Then, several teams practiced getting into a small dropship, flying over near the flower, and people in suits crossed the remaining distance to the flower as an assault team. Using Krestang-powered armor suits in deep space was very different from playing around with them in a cargo hold. Many times Skippy had to seize control of suits to prevent the wearers from hurting themselves or others. We all learned together, slowly. The suits by themselves had small thruster units, which allowed the wearer to prevent spinning out of control. The suit thrusters weren't much use for flying across distances. We had a sort of jetpack that could be attached to a suit. The jetpacks were bulky, and we only had 14 of them, and we shouldn't need them to get across the short distance between a dropship airlock and the space station. What we practiced was one person launching him or herself from the dropship's airlock, carrying a line. When the line was firmly attached to the flower, the rest of the team followed by pulling themselves along the line. We also practiced recovering people who had gone spinning off into space. That was good practice for our inexperienced dropship pilots. And if any of those people had gone spinning off into space by accident, that only made the recovery exercise more realistic. One of those unfortunate people who had accidentally gone spinning off into space and needed to be recovered had a name like Schmo Bishop. That guy really felt like an idiot. After 2 full days of intensive exercise, during which every Spec Ops team and every pilot had multiple opportunities for practice, I was satisfied that we were ready enough to investigate the space station for real. We approached our very first target slowly and carefully, initially jumping in to the far edge of the star system and sitting there quietly for 18 hours. Our passive sensors listened for any signs of activity, no matter how faint, and found nothing. Next, we jumped in about 1,000,000 kilometers from the target and listened for another 6 hours, although Skippy complained that he'd gotten all the useful data in the first 3 hours. So I listened to him complain for hours. That was a real treat for me. Finally, we went to battle stations and jumped within 100,000 kilometers of the supposedly abandoned space station. The pilots were on a hair trigger for an emergency jump away. They didn't need to wait for an order from the duty officer. "Skippy," I asked anxiously, "what do you think? Is this place really abandoned?" "Give me a break, Joe. I'm stuck with the speed of light here. Everything is incredibly freaking slow. There are no ships in the area. The whole area certainly appears to be dead. Nothing out there is generating power. What I can't tell yet is whether there are any hazards like stealth mines. That's what I'm scanning for now. With this ship's crappy sensors, it will take an hour for a full grid search. I have to warn you, Joe. In order to verify there are no booby traps inside the station, we need to move the ship close. I'm talking about physical devices like explosives attached to airlocks, that sort of thing. I need to be closer. Like within 12,000 kilometers.
Oh.
12,000 kilometers. That sounded way too close to me. The distances involved in space combat were hard to comprehend. All my military experience involved line-of-sight warfare. Even in space, with nothing between me and the target, I couldn't actually see anything from 12,000 kilometers away. The problem with space combat was the enormous distances involved. Distances so vast that even light took seconds or minutes to cross the gap. Against the distances separating combatants were the speeds of the weapons. Masers, particle beams, hypervelocity railguns, missiles that could accelerate at 5,000 times the force of gravity. From our position a mere 100,000 kilometers away from the station, we were in danger from speed of light weapons, which our shields could deflect long enough for us to jump away. If we went in only 12,000 kilometers, a railgun or even a missile could close that distance, punch right through our shields, and knock out a reactor before we could jump. Did I want to take the risk of bringing the ship in that close? Can we send a dropship instead? No, I need this ship's sensors.
This may all look like magic to you monkeys, Joe, but this is technology, and even for me it has limits.
Damn. All right, pilot, I said to Desai. Bring us in. If you think anything is a threat out there, don't wait for me. Jump us away.
Aye, aye, sir, she acknowledged.
There were no threats, and Skippy declared no booby traps. At least no booby traps in the outer layers of the station structure. The space station appeared to be exactly what that data Skippy captured said it was, an abandoned wreck. From 12,000 kilometers, we could clearly see holes had been blasted in it, jagged holes, and there were structures that had been torn away like tissue paper, with pipes and cables sticking out. Because people could get tangled up in those cables flopping around, we needed to avoid those areas. That was not a problem. We located several airlocks with no obstructions and easy approaches for a dropship. There was also an open docking bay, plenty large enough for several dropships. That was tempting. Maybe too tempting. I wanted a dropship to be able to get away quickly. That meant avoiding confined areas like an open docking bay that could be a trap. What I decided was for a single one of our smaller dropships to go in with two pilots, plus me, Giraud, and two others. Giraud had removed the healing sleeve from his arm and found that it was very nearly as strong as the other arm and had declared himself fit for duty. Dr. Skippy agreed. That was good enough for me. Desai backed the Flying Dutchman off to 50,000 kilometers away, and I left Chang in command. As the two pilots of the dropship were British, I chose Captain Zhou of the Chinese team and Captain Chander of the Indian team to go in with me and Giraud to make our initial exploration team truly international. It was very important, I thought, to avoid the appearance of me playing favorites among the five nations that comprised UNEF. The pilots parked the dropship 50 meters away from the airlock we selected, and we opened the dropship's own airlock. Giraud went first. He flew across the 50 meters of vacuum and missed the airlock by only a meter. He was able to grasp a handhold and pulled himself over to the airlock and attached the line. I followed, with the Indian and Chinese soldiers right behind, pulling ourselves along the line. The armored glove of Giraud's hand touched the airlock door, and nothing happened. "I suppose it's too much to hope the power is still on," he said, bending down to peer at the dust-covered panel to the right of the door. "After all this time..." Moving as carefully as he could, he tried to brush the accumulated layer of dust away from the panel. Most of it smeared or clung to his gloves. "That didn't work," he complained. "We should have brought a brush with us, or a towel. Where did all this dust come from?"
"Debris from the battle that caused the station to be abandoned," Skippy explained. "The station's surface was slightly magnetized from its defensive shield. When the shield was deactivated, particles were attracted to it." "There is not that much dust, Captain. The problem is your gloves are only smearing it around."
"You see any lights on the panel, Giraud?" I asked. The view from his helmet camera was available on the inside of my helmet faceplate. I could toggle the display either on my left wrist pad or with my chin. Although I hadn't quite gotten the knack of doing it with my chin, I kept flipping the display back and forth annoyingly. The view from his helmet camera was distracting. He was moving around too much. I pulled myself over next to him, far enough away not to hover over his shoulder and distract him.
"It's hard to tell," he answered. "The light is very harsh here, without an atmosphere to filter it."
Giraud had a good point. All of our zero-gravity training had been in deep interstellar space with artificial lights provided by the Dutchman, the Flower, or a dropship. I should have thought of how being in intense starlight would affect people in suits. "All right, we can't stay out here. Try the handle," I ordered. The door, like almost all airlocks, had a manual release mechanism for use in case of power failure. This door had a nice, big, obvious lever, painted yellow and red on the right side.
"Trying it now?" Giraud said.
I could see his right hand reach out and grasp the lever, then turn it to the left. Immediately, a loud trilling sound blasted out of my helmet speakers.
"Get out of there!" I shouted. "Retreat! Wait. Wait, everyone wait!"
I recognized that trilling sound from somewhere. The trilling sound repeated. Then I heard voices. Human voices. It was difficult to make out what they were saying.
"Skippy, what the hell is that?"
"Oh, that's Soulfinger by the Barquets."
"Soulfinger? Oh, my God, what the hell is that song doing all the way out here?"
I looked around. Everyone I could see had their mouths agape with astonishment. Why in the hell did a Kristang space station abandoned hundreds of years ago have a human 1960s funk R&B song as a door alarm? My brain almost locked up in confusion.
"What? Duh,
It doesn't, Joe. The real airlock alarm is a boring beep-beep sound. I spiced up the signal for you over your helmet speakers.
Oh. Hey, you dumb monkeys thought that was real?
Oh, man, this is freaking hilarious. Oh, damn, Joe. You should have seen the expression on your faces. Man, now that was truly priceless. Damn! I've got to do that again sometime.
I was pissed. No, you got to do that again never. Understand? You scared the hell out of me, Skippy. I could have been dangerous if someone had moved too quickly and been injured. Everyone, do you see now the crap I have to put up with from our friendly beer can?
Colonel, Giraud responded, I've told you before. Anytime you want Skippy to take a long ride out an airlock, you let me know. I'll be happy to do it for you.
We got the outer door open, and then the inner door, and discovered there was a thin residual atmosphere in parts of the station. Skippy warned us not to try popping open our faceplates and sniffing the air. It was too thin, he reported, and contaminated with dangerously toxic chemicals left over from the battle. Skippy didn't need to warn us. No one was tempted to open our spacesuits. The inside of the station looked very much like the inside of the Flower, a standard Cristang design that had changed little in several hundred years. Our captured frigate, the Flower itself, was almost 200 years old, and Skippy said the Cristang were still building frigates that were almost identical today. Our investigation of the space station took 2 full days and was a complete bust. We found only a few useless pieces of Elder artifacts. It wasn't clear who was more bitterly disappointed, me or Skippy. After 46 straight hours of rotating teams in and out of the station, we had poked our noses into every nook and cranny of the place and not found anything useful.
Skippy, is there any point to us staying here longer?
The Cristang put a space station here because an Elder starship broke apart in orbit. Is there a chance they missed something? Should we scan space around the planet? See if we find any Elder artifacts?
I already did that, Joe, Skippy responded. Space around here is empty of anything useful. The lizards did a good job of picking up all the valuable pieces. They should have. The station was operational here almost 200 years before the conflict damaged it. Plenty of time to survey every cubic meter of space for 500,000 kilometers from the planet. Even dumb-dumb lizards couldn't miss finding all the good stuff when they have 200 years to do it. The answer is no. There is no point to us remaining here any longer, unless you find it useful for crew training. The Flying Dutchman had hung motionless in space, exposed for far too long. I wanted us to get the hell out of there and onto our next objective. Our next objective, which we still hadn't decided on. I ordered an end to the exploration effort as soon as the Chinese team aboard the station could be extracted. Colonel Chang, I said over my Z-phone, we're pulling out. Get your team back aboard the dropship as soon as you can do so safely.
Yes, sir, Chang replied. This is a good opportunity for training, but there is nothing useful for us over here. We'll be back aboard the Dutchman within an hour.
News that we were pulling out quickly spread throughout the ship, and within less than 10 minutes, Skippy called me while I was in my office.
Joe, Dr. Venkman is on her way to see you. The science team asked her to talk to you about...
Skippy, are you about to tell me something you overheard? Remember the talk we had about privacy?
Sure, but... Does whatever you heard pose a threat to this ship?
No, but... Listen, Skippy. You want people to treat you as a person and not as a computer, right?
Yes.
Here is what a person would do, assuming the person is a friend. He would simply say something like, Heads up, dude, Venkman's on her way to pester you.
I am not calling you dude, Joe.
How about chum?
Damn, Skippy. You need some context of your understanding of slang. Nobody has used the word chum that way since, like... Nerdy English boarding schools in the 1930s. Chum is fish guts you throw over the side of the boat as bait.
You sure about that?
Pretty sure, yeah. You call someone chum, and that majorly sets off their social awkwardness alarm.
Damn, you monkeys just came out of the freaking trees and already you've got inscrutable social rules.
All right, how about if I simply say, Joe, Venkman's on the warpath and she's on the way to your office?
Now that's cool, Skippy. You're getting the idea.
Unbelievable. An entire galaxy for me to learn about after being asleep for 1,000,000 years, and what am I cluttering up my memory with? the current social customs of filthy, ignorant monkeys. Oh, man, I am totally wasting my life. How much unused memory do you have? I tried to remember a ginormous number that was in some Wikipedia article I glanced at. It's measured in yottabytes, something like that.
Ha! A puny yottabyte!
For a moment he was laughing so hard he couldn't speak.
Damn, that is precious. Joey, a yottabyte is such a tiny part of my memory capacity I couldn't measure something that small. A yottabyte?
He chuckled.
That's a good one.
Uh-huh. So you learning about monkey... damn it! Now you've got me calling us monkeys. Info about human social customs doesn't take up a significant part of your memory, so what's the harm?
The harm?
What's the harm in a few worms and an apple, Joe? What's the harm in a few bacteria on your food?
It's the contamination that I'm worried about.
Come on, it wasn't that long ago that the social customs of your species were limited to picking lice out of each other's fur and eating the lice. Yuck.
Hey, those lice have got to go somewhere. They're loaded with protein.
Oh, my God. See? It's having that kind of thinking anywhere in my memory that worries me. To have monkey ideas in my...
Hello, Mr. Or is it Captain? Venkman knocked on the frame of the door to my office. Or Colonel Bishop. They didn't give us a briefing on military protocol before we left.
Hello, Doctor, I said, rose from my chair and gestured for her to sit.
And my rank is Colonel. My position aboard the ship is Captain. I guess you call me Colonel. That's the easiest, I think. Very well, Colonel.
She glanced around my office. Nothing more than a Theranin storage closet that had been emptied out and outfitted with a desk and three chairs. And a small cabinet that, so far, didn't have anything in it. The only items I had added were a laptop that I rarely used, an iPad that I used all the time, and a coffee mug that I'd taken from the galley and not yet returned. No paper, no pencils or pens, no calendar with pretty landscape photos, not even a photo of my family. I should have brought one. There hadn't been time before we left.
I'm told that you have ordered the ship to prepare to leave this star system, she said, to proceed to the next target, because we did not locate an Elder communications node here. The science team, myself included, would like you to reconsider. We would appreciate an opportunity to collect more data about this system. We have been using the ship's extraordinary sensors and have gathered valuable information. However, the data we've collected to date presents an incomplete picture. Without a complete data set to analyze, we won't be able to draw any conclusions. And none of the science team has been aboard the alien station yet. We've seen the video sent back by the Special Forces teams. It is not the same as being there.
This was a conversation I didn't want to have. Shouldn't need to have. We had covered this subject already.
Before we left Earth, I wrote down our mission objectives so everyone who signed on would understand exactly why the Dutchman was going back out, and so they were completely 100% aware of the risk they'd be taking by coming aboard. My hope had been to discourage people from coming aboard. It hadn't worked. Here the objectives are in easy-to-read bullet format, something I'd seen recommended in officer training somewhere. 1. Prevent other species from discovering humans had stolen a warship and were involved in shutting down a wormhole. 2. Where it doesn't interfere with item 1, keep Skippy satisfied that we are making a serious effort to help him contact the collective. 3. Where it doesn't interfere with items 1 and 2 above, return the crew safely to Earth someday, if we can. Like that's ever going to happen. That last sentence wasn't actually part of the written objectives, it was my own comment. Now you might think the order of the first two items were reversed, that the whole purpose of the Dutchman going back out was for Skippy to contact the collective. You would be correct about the purpose of the trip, however, that was not the primary objective for the crew. We owed Skippy our loyalty. We didn't owe him so much loyalty that we would risk the safety of our home planet and our entire species. Humans stealing a starship was bad enough. The Theranin would be immensely pissed. But starships being destroyed or captured, even by lesser species, was not all that unusual. If the Maxulks or Rindaloo ever learned humans had a way to manipulate wormholes, a technology even they could only dream of, they would rip our planet apart to get our secret. And you might think Objective 2 should be simply help Skippy contact the collective. You would be wrong there. We didn't know whether it was possible to contact the Collective, even whether they still existed, or had ever existed. Skippy's memory in that area was not the greatest. All we could do is make Skippy happy that we were keeping up our end of the bargain until he either contacted the Collective or gave up. Keep Skippy happy that we were making a sincere effort to help him, whether we actually were able to usefully help him or not. In the back of my mind was a time limit of maybe a year that we would devote to helping Skippy. If we hadn't found a way to contact the Collective by then, my plan was to gently persuade Skippy to give up that particular quest. How I could convince a stubborn alien AI who could devote 1,000 years to a task without thinking about it was something I'd figure out when we got there. For me, this constitutes fairly advanced planning compared to the way I normally do things. The most important objective for prospective crew members to read was number 3. Not so much the text of that objective, but its position in the mission objective's order of priorities. Our return to Earth, our survival, was 3rd in line. Everyone needed to understand that. If they didn't believe it, they could go stare at the collection of self-destruct tactical nuclear devices in one of our cargo bays. Perhaps even more important for prospective crew members was Objective 4. Oh? There is no Objective 4 on the list, you say? You are correct. There is no 4th objective like learning important sciencey stuff, or exploring the galaxy, or getting intel about our potential enemies, or gathering useful advanced technology equipment, or even engaging in special operations warfare against the enemies of mankind. If we could do any of those not one of our objectives things without interfering with the 3 stated objectives, then great. If not, that's tough. I was not going to risk mission success or lives to make our science team happy, and I sure as hell wasn't going to approve any combat operations unless we absolutely had no choice. Or, I guess technically, unless engaging in combat was a better option than not engaging in combat. If that meant our gung-ho special forces and brainy science team were unhappy and bored, so be it. In fact, I would consider our mission a complete success if we were able to return to Earth safely without a single dangerous or interesting thing happening. Semper tedium could be our motto. Always boredom. I'd be happy with that. Which is why I was mildly irritated that Venkman brought up the subject now. Actually, not irritated that she raised the question. She had a right to ask, just as I had a right to say no. What irritated me was her attitude, that I had ordered the Dutchman to prepare for departure. Only because of my ignorance, I couldn't see the potential for important scientific discoveries right where we are. What I wanted to do was tell her flatly no, hell no, and not to question my orders again. Doing that would have only proved her point that I was too young and inexperienced to command a starship, or for that matter, a rowboat. Slapping her down would have felt good. Commanders don't often get to do what feels good. They have to do what is good for the mission, and sowing dissension among the crew would have hurt morale. No matter how large the Flying Dutchman was, we had 70 people living in a limited space, seeing the same bulkheads every day. At least I, and most of the soldiers and pilots, had been able to get off the Dutchman, going over to the Kristang space station and look at something different for a while. The science team had been stuck inside the ship since they came aboard. I tried to let her down gently. Doctor, I appreciate your eagerness for scientific inquiry, I said, surprising myself at using such fancy words. And I need to balance that potential gain in humanity's understanding of the universe against the risk of us being discovered here. The longer we remain here, the greater the risk to the overall mission and to all our lives. This star system, particularly because it previously had a Kristang presence, has an unacceptably high risk that enemy ships could jump in here at any moment, and we can't risk that. I'm sorry, Doctor. You may use the ship's sensors as long as you do not interfere with the crew until we are ready to jump.
Captain, perhaps we...
Dr. Venkman, I waved a hand to stop her from talking. You may be used to an academic setting where discussion and debate are encouraged. This is a military vessel, a warship. As the commander, I welcome advice from my staff. However, once I have made a decision, it is final and not open to debate. We might be traveling between the stars together for a long time. I thought it important to lay the ground rules early and avoid problems later. I was 100% right. I still felt like a jerk.